Good morning to all of you. Welcome. The edifice in the back of the temple, which those of you who come regularly know is not always there, was created for a celebration we had last night. Every year, those who are members of this temple gather for a candlelight tea, in which we simply enjoy each other's company and great beauty. The temple is transformed for the event, and this is the can't bear to take it down quite yet result of that. I receive a newsletter from a Swami Mangalananda who lives in some rural area of India and runs an ashram and a school for the local children. And he's a disciple of Anandamoyi Ma. Anandamoyi Ma is known through autobiography of a yogi. There's a chapter called The Joy Permeated Mother. For those of you who've read Yogananda's book, you may remember her from there. Anandamoyi Ma is not in this direct lineage, but she is a very close member of our extended spiritual family, is the only way I can say it. Our founder, Swami Kriyananda, who's an American disciple of Yogananda, when he spent years in India, he spent a lot of time with Anandamoyi Ma. She died in 1982. David, my husband, when he went to India in 1979, had the opportunity to see her. Not many of us have had the chance, so it's a very special thing because she was a very great soul. Her mission was in India. She never left that country. But she offered a great many truths, and Swami Mangalananda in his newsletter often tells us things she said or did. And he made a comment. He said, even though she lived until 1982, so many of the people who came to see her were products of the New Age revolution in America. I mean, a lot of young Americans went to India, many drug-inspired spiritual seekers, or just sort of working not in a conventional religious context, but sort of making it up in a new way. And Swami Mangalananda said, quoting Ma, that she never used a modern vocabulary when she was talking about spiritual things. She was, in fact, a very traditional Indian woman in her outward manner. But she never spoke of, you know, expanding the limits of the mind, or, you know, she never used any New Age words at all, ever. And in fact, at one point she said, to talk about expanding consciousness without also talking about God is euphoric self-indulgence. It was a very interesting phrase. That with all of this was just in order to get to that phrase, euphoric self-indulgence. By now, my teenage years and my 20s are actual history that children study, which is a very weird feeling. But in any case, having grown up through that era, in which, and we have to say that drugs had something to do with it, in which the conventional view of reality and the conventional expectations for all of us bright, privileged children, the baby boomers as we were, just was blown out of the water. A mother of a friend of mine just remarked that every family had lost at least one child, you know, from the track that they were supposed to be on, which was the good college, graduate school, professional track, to go off to milk goats and grow organic food. And she remarked philosophically, because it was true in her own family, and it was usually the best and most promising child, was the one who went off to do that. Now, you know, decades have passed, and many people have found their way sort of back into the system one way or another. You know, the necessity of raising families and so on is real. And some of the rest of us who made that left turn never came back. You know? Exhibit A. We moved out into the lunatic fringe, as we called ourselves lovingly, and we just stayed there. You know, we were vegetarians when people thought we would die if we didn't eat meat. It was really a radical revolution. But we were never really hippies, even though we looked a great deal like hippies and in many ways behaved like hippies. We weren't hippies in this respect, We were not seeking euphoric self-indulgence. Now, maybe that was the beginning, because there was a certain rigidity to our culture in which rules rather than experience was the criteria of behavior. When some of the young people, the product of this spirit, had in our community of Ananda in those early years, and it was quite a mixed bag population. There were many people were there for many reasons. At the beginning, as Swamiji said, when you start a community, you have to have somebody in it. So you can your standards have to be a little more open. I mean, it got to the point in the first summer, as they said, when if you swore that you hadn't taken drugs in a while and you could chant Om, then you were allowed to move in. Later it got a little more fixed than that, but there had to be somebody there. So there was a group of these people asking Swami Kriyananda, who was a very traditional monk of the Sannyas order, you know, a member of a very dignified and noble spiritual tradition, and they're asking him about drugs and about the sexual revolution and all of these different things, and he speaks very strongly against mind-altering drugs, but even he had to admit that sometimes those experiences catalyzed people into something much more serious, because it broke in an instant the myth of this world by the realization that if you shift consciousness, you shift everything. That really was the message of that experience. For the first time, people were able to use that word, oh, consciousness. You can shift consciousness, and then all perception is different. If you just then sought euphoric self-indulgence, you really weren't going anywhere. But if that catalyzed you to seek a real change of consciousness, one that you could hold and not just dimly remember happened back there, maybe somewhere, that's entirely different. So even Swamiji, strongly as he feels about such things, had to admit that the fruit of it wasn't all terrible. And as for the complete collapse of conventional morality, his response was, well, at least people are making experience their criteria rather than someone else's opinion or external rules. And then he said, and if you're honest in your experience, he said, your own experience will lead you back to the same wisdom that has always been true for the ages, if you're honest in your experience, which is to really discern between a flash of energy and a true lasting experience of happiness. Because that is the age we're moving into. We are shifting, the planet is shifting from Kali Yuga, which is an age of form and rules, into Dwapara Yuga, which is a time where energy and the experience of energy itself becomes the criteria of our understanding. You see what a huge difference that is? You see it, you know, you see it in every area of life, but you certainly see it in religion. Religion used to be just about the rules. If you just did the right thing, you were more or less guaranteed that you would get to heaven. There was a joke that Swami told recently that I really enjoyed, where a very wealthy man dies and he goes up to heaven, and St. Peter is showing him around. And first they're in a beautiful neighborhood filled with mansions, then they're in a nice suburban area, then they're in really tacky tract housing, and then they're finally in a slum, and then in the worst slum he gets his dwelling. He said, why am I given such a place like this? I had 5 beautiful homes back when I was on earth. He said, well, he said, but this is all the material you send up here for us to build for you. You know, there were rules, and you followed them or you didn't follow them. One of my friends, ex-Catholic, was told in the second grade that the reason he should follow the rules is then when he got to heaven, he would have a bigger house. He spoke of this with deep gratitude to the nuns who told him this, because it freed him from any necessity to follow any of the rules after that. You know, he would live in a small place, no problem for him. You know, the trade-off seems self-evidently worth it, right? But people simply did the right thing in an external sense, and there was an expectation that it would be enough. And my generation just somehow saw the myth in that. And we saw the myth in it because there was a rise in consciousness on the planet that we were responding to and that the world has been carrying on ever since, which is that now we have to really see the reality of things and not just the appearance of things. Well, in fact, this is exactly what this Bible verse is. They talk about Moses, they talk about Jesus, but Moses was a true master who came at a certain time, and as Swamiji explains it, at a time when out of a disparate tribes of people who had been enslaved, he needed to form a nation, and he formed that nation by laying out the rules, the Ten Commandments and the 600 or so other laws, for the time and place, because every master has the same consciousness. But once that master incarnates in a specific form, Moses, Buddha, Krishna, Yogananda, Christ, whoever that form is, then their mission is defined by the time and place in which they're born and the karma of their disciples. So Moses was the first avatar for the Jews. Moses is really the founder of Judaism. The Jews don't think about it like that anymore, but that doesn't mean it's not true. Moses founded Judaism, and what was needed then were these laws. And it's not really about the Jews, and it's not really about how much better Jesus is than Moses or anything like that. It's just about the different ways in which God manifests at different times and places, all of which represent our own personal progression. Because we have to start by beginning to understand what the basic principles of right living are. And different spiritual expressions, spiritual practices, are all dependent on where we are on that spectrum. If we don't even have any appearance of right living, we have to start by understanding what that means. You know, the Ten Commandments are a nice place to start. You marry one person and you're faithful to that person. And you don't go around stealing other people's goods. And gee, you don't pick up a heavy object and crack somebody else's head open. No, no, that's not good. I mean, now we can laugh at this because we don't have to write on our hand, you know, today, don't murder anyone, you know, don't steal anybody else's goods, because we're past the point where we really have to be told the basics of behavior. We're moving beyond mere adherence to the law. I met a man once, he was actually interviewing me on the radio many years ago about Ananda Village, where I was living at that time, and that the reason I was on the radio program was about the community proper. It was about organic gardening, going back to the land, milking goats, and which I've never milked a goat in my life, but there I was talking about milking goats, you know, just representing that lifestyle. And before we talked, I learned a little bit about the man before we went on the air. He'd had a very rough upbringing. He'd been a drug addict, and now he was gratefully off substances and was solid. I didn't get this other little fact until we were later on the air, because when he began to find out that I had an Indian guru and practiced yoga, it turns out he was a fundamentalist Christian, and he felt deeply obligated by his faith to testify that I was going to hell and that he wasn't on the radio. Okay. Now, it's a principle not to hurt someone else's faith. That's a very bad thing to do. Because if it's working for them, you don't want to pull the rug out from under them, no matter what you know. If it's not working for them and they come and ask you questions, that's quite something else. It's not that you can never speak, but the desire has to come from the person. I'm talking to this man whose alternative was to be a drug addict on the street. You know, this is not a man who can deal with real subtle, you know, shades of things. This man needs a law, and he needs salvation, and he needs the certainty that I have given my life to Jesus Christ and now it's all okay. You know, and no caring person would touch that. So I didn't touch it. I said, well, let's talk about the goats. And when he wouldn't talk about the goats, I refused to talk at all. I don't care. We're just going to have silence on the radio until we go back to what we're really here to talk about. Because he needed the law. But there comes a point in our spiritual life where the form, we can do the form, and what really matters is what's in our hearts. You know, most of us can do the form pretty well right now because our experience has told us what part of that form is worth following, you see. We may not still follow all the specific tenets, you know, all the different ways that you can be damned to hell in the Catholic religion and all the different ways that you can really fail as a Jew and every way that you can fail as a Muslim or as a Hindu. Every single one of them has these long lists. Some of them are fiercer than others. Some of the paths are narrower. But they all have a point at which you've crossed over, and then that's just it, you know. But by the time you come to a temple of self-realization, you've had enough inner experience to be picking and choosing among other people's ideas what it is that really moves you. And the criteria becomes our own experience. And the basis of that experience is very simple. What gives us joy and what alleviates suffering. And fundamentally, that's all everybody is doing. Whatever style of life they're living, whether they call it spiritual or not, whether they're completely worldly in the sense of committed to the life that you see through the senses and not thinking about anything more subtle or not, everybody moves as an attempt to get away from suffering and to come closer to an experience of joy. And Yogananda himself in the end said, this is the definition of spirituality. Because the fact of the matter is, joy is the end point. From joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt again. And the only spirituality we have is living in such a way that we have that experience. And in our reading today, we comment, you have the experience of divine love, and then kindness is natural. You have the experience of the wisdom of the divine in this universe, and then naturally you try to create justice for all. Because we see that justice is the natural expression of that wisdom. We don't work it from the outside. We have to treat everybody fairly. That's a beginning point. But we always have to understand behind everything we're doing, where does it really emanate from? In Swami Kriyananda, as an example in my life that I've had the opportunity to observe for more than 40 years now, many different times with him, I've had this increasingly subtle understanding, because I would see him behave in certain ways, and I would project upon him the belief that he was disciplining himself to a principle. And then what I could gradually begin to understand is that he was manifesting a consciousness. Example I've told you about before that I'll just remind you of briefly here. I'm 22 years younger than he is, or 22 years, I think, 21 or 22. And because I met him when I was in my early 20s and I began to work for him as a personal assistant essentially for the first 10 years of my life there, I worked for him during my 20s. I wasn't as smart as I thought I was. Let's just put it like that. I didn't hesitate to be forceful in my point of view, and my point of view was often wrong. Never in all the time that I have known him has he made reference to my youth or my inexperience. And I recognize now that I would think I would have sorely tempted him. You know, it's almost an inevitable thought to silence, you know, sometimes annoyingly exuberant youthful energy by saying, what do you know, kid? You know, there's just so many ways you can cheat just to try to push the energy away from you. Never once, not even the smallest. And when I finally really realized this, because I got old enough to be on the other side of the equation, I expressed my gratitude. And he looked so puzzled when I expressed my gratitude. It was so interesting. I know him well, and in subtle things, and he sort of accepted my compliment graciously, but there was this puzzled look in his eye. Thank you, I said, sir, for never referring to my age. And then he said, I never noticed. We all look at each other and we see the form, isn't it so? You know, someone remarked once that gender is the first thing you notice about a person and the last thing you forget. when you remember nothing else, and the police ask, you know, what did the robber look like? Well, it was a man. You know, that's about all you can say sometime, but you rarely don't notice gender. In fact, it doesn't even occur to us that gender isn't part of what you're looking at. I mean, who you are. I am a man. I am a woman. Swami says, I never noticed. And I know for a fact, Swami doesn't notice gender either. He said to this girl once, Nirmala actually, they were out somewhere and there was a dress in the window. And it was a very unattractive dress. And he turned to her and he said, if you were a woman, would you wear that? She says, well, sir, as it happens, I am a woman. He said about Shivani once years ago. Shivani's a woman also, a very powerful woman. And Swami was at some program, and this was in the 70s when there was this big man-woman fight going on all the time. And it was a program of spiritual teachers, and every spiritual teacher was a man. And so there was this huge movement of the women were all mad because there were no women speakers. And so they came to Swami, and Shivani was a very competent speaker, but she wasn't on the level of the rest of them. And they said, you know, we want Shivani to speak so there'll be a woman represented. And Swami looked at them and said, Shivani's not a woman. You know, gender, body gender notwithstanding, you're not dealing with a woman here. You know, because he was looking at reality. You know, what is female, what is male? Men and women express divine realities to greater and lesser degrees. Your body's quite incidental. Shivani's not a woman, and she isn't. There was a class once, poor Shivani, if you ever hear this, forgive me, but this is the truth, and you know it. We were coming into a class that Swamiji was giving, and she and I arrived at the door at the same time. This was in 1970s or 80s, and the class was how to deal with your emotions. Shivani said, I'm so interested in this class on emotions. Last night, I think I had one. We just are what we are, form notwithstanding. Now, where on earth was I in all of this? Oh, I was talking about the necessity to really live from who we are and what we really know. And that's what the progression that Jesus was bringing and that Yogananda has brought even further into our spiritual lives is it really isn't about the form. Oh, I know where I really wanted to go. This is back. This is all the way back to Anandamayi Ma. We really can't be on the spiritual path just for euphoric self-indulgence. For a very, very simple reason. It really won't bring us the euphoria that we hope it will bring us. Because what we're looking here to do, and this is what experience will really tell us, is that we can make this little ego self more and more powerful. And that's kind of, there's kind of two tracks happening right now in what you might call the expanding consciousness movement. And the one track is the track that what do we need with religion anymore? What do we need with these old rules anymore? What do we need with these rituals anymore? You know, we can do it. We create our own reality. We'll just get together here and we'll make the right thoughts and we know what the right thing is. And even very well intended, the energy really is that we're just going to get bigger and stronger in myself. And even when we move into, quote, expanded consciousness, if we're still just thinking from the origin point that is the most self-evident one, which is my little ego moving through this world, is going to live correctly and then everything's going to come out all right. And then there's another track. And I'm not even talking about what you might call mainstream or traditional, or I would call it Kali Yuga religious approaches. There's another track that looks a little bit the same. And in the early years of Ananda, we actually used to have these very strange conflicts because there were a lot of people who were into expanding consciousness, but they were not into God. They were not into this real understanding that which we call ourselves is not really us at all. That we are just manifestations of something much more beautiful than this little limited consciousness can ever be, no matter how much we puff it up with positive thinking or anything like that. In other words, there is this innate humility and awe in the face of something much greater, which leads spontaneously to worship. And what Anandamoyi Ma was saying is, without that experience of our own, not insignificance, because we are loved, but the truth of our own actual nature, which is, I really cannot make the bubble the whole sea. The wave can be part of the ocean, but the wave can't declare, I am the ocean, unless the wave ceases to see itself as the wave anymore. Do you see? And there's a tremendous need for a certain courage in just declaring God, and not feeling every time we say it, we have to go into some long disclaimer about what we really mean by that. I was very pleased to see a little snippet of Oprah Winfrey, who is not a person that I like or dislike. She's just, I know she's a very powerful woman in this world, self-made, and I respect that. I don't have any much more relationship to her, but apparently at the end of her enormous career of her television program, she gave a "this is what I believe" sort of goodbye speech. And the piece of it that I heard about and saw was, she started talking about God, and she's a very plain spoken woman, which I also really like. And she said, "And don't give me any trouble about this. You know what I mean when I say God," like that. "The big guy," she said, "the big one," you know, like this, in a very just straight way. And then she just said, "And that's where the power comes from, and we all know it." I mean, it was just like, let us be that way. We know where the power comes from. We don't have to apologize for it. Everything else is just euphoric self-indulgence. And where is that going to take us in the end? We know. We've been there. We've been pushing that envelope as far as it'll go, and it just rips into pieces, doesn't it? Looks like it's going to work, but it doesn't. Experience is our criteria. We're not following laws now. We're following truth. We're following grace. And that grace tells us we're little bubbles in the great ocean of spirit, and it's that ocean of spirit that we have to worship. And to worship is such a beautiful word. Worship is to put in the center of your reality, let it be the defining force of what you do. And how do we worship that? In everything we do. How shall I worship thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe? Just with every breath I breathe, we live in that experience. And then we come to, would you hand me your book? And open it where you were. Thank you. Then we come to this amazing last verse in the Bhagavad Gita. "Nay, but once more, take my last word, my utmost meaning have. Precious thou art to me, right well beloved. Listen, I tell thee for thy comfort this. Give me thy heart, adore me, serve me, cling in faith and love and reverence to me. So shalt thou come to me, I promise, for thou art sweet to me. And let go those rites and writ duties, fly to me alone, make me thy single refuge. I will free thy soul from all its sins. Be of good cheer." Isn't that wonderful? God bless you.